The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
We join Dr. Brittany Dean inside the Lunchtime Doctor right here on Freedom as we are joined by our sister station Sky 99.5 FM and, of course, Sangeet 106.1 FM. So let's say a good afternoon to you, Dr. Dean.
Good afternoon, Tasca, and good afternoon to all our listeners out there. It is the last episode for the week, but we have an interesting and insightful episode planned. But of course, you know, while we're talking about this specific topic, anybody can feel free to call in, send their messages, their WhatsApps, and we can have a conversation on any of your medical issues. But today's topic is going to be an interesting but also a very serious one that I'm not too sure a lot of people may have heard about before, but it's something that we do see, unfortunately, on a daily basis in the hospital setting. So it's important that we know about it. We know about the risk factors for developing it and even the complications and the management of this specific condition. So this is the episode on pulmonary embolism today.
And what exactly is a pulmonary embolism and how does it affect the body?
So do you know how we get clots in different areas and that can lead to different complications? For example, if you get a clot in the vessel in the heart, that can lead to heart attacks, or a clot in the vessel in the brain, that can lead to a stroke. Well, a pulmonary embolism is really just a blood clot that lodges in the pulmonary arteries of the lungs, and that causes a host of different symptoms. Remember, the lungs are the organs that are responsible for taking air into the body and, of course, giving that oxygen to the rest of the body via the blood vessels, etc. So if you have a blockage that is going to impede the blood flow to the lungs, that is going to lead to decreased oxygen levels in the blood and, of course, increase a lot of pressure on the right side of the heart. Now, a pulmonary embolism actually is something, or a blood clot, that originates mostly from the leg. So when the clot is found in the deep veins of the legs, a condition that we know as deep vein thrombosis, that clot can actually travel through the bloodstream and lodge in the pulmonary arteries of the lungs. Now, the severity of a pulmonary embolism does vary. So if somebody has a small emboli or a small clot, that may cause minimal symptoms in that person, but large clots, as you can imagine, can be very fatal if they are not promptly treated. Now, the obstruction that is caused by this clot or this pulmonary embolism, or for short we call it a PE, that actually prevents oxygen from reaching the lung tissue, and that can result in damage or infarction of lung segments. So the same way that you can have an infarction of a part of the heart where you have no oxygen going to that part of the heart, and that leads to necrosis of that part of the heart, or tissue dying, that can lead to tissue dying in certain parts of the lungs as well. And that disruption actually affects the body's ability to oxygenate our blood effectively, and that's going to lead to many different symptoms. So people are going to get shortness of breath, chest pain, dizziness, and in severe cases, it causes what we call hemodynamic instability. So that is going to lead to shock in the body and even sudden death for some people. So it is crucial for us to understand a pulmonary embolism so that we can have people recognize the early signs and symptoms and seek management, because that timely intervention is going to significantly reduce the morbidity and even the mortality that is associated with the condition.
All right, folks, good afternoon. Welcome to your Lunchtime Doctor today. As always, we will be taking a break in a short while to answer any of your medical questions. It's Wednesday, so it's the final Lunchtime Doctor for the week, so try to get those questions in. I believe, is a pulmonary embolism always linked to deep vein thrombosis, or can it occur in other ways?
So the first thing to know is that the primary cause of a pulmonary embolism is that deep vein thrombosis, and that is where blood clots form in the deep veins of the legs or even in the pelvis. So there are factors that we have to look at that contribute to that clot formation in the legs. So if somebody has prolonged immobility, meaning that they are on bed rest after surgery for a long period of time, or if they have very long flights, if they have injury to the vein walls in the legs, so from surgery or trauma, and even if they have a state in their body that is what we call hypercoagulable, meaning that they clot easily. So people who have cancer or even genetic clotting disorders, these people are more prone to developing that clot in the legs. And once formed, that clot can actually dislodge from the legs and travel through the venous system to the lungs, where it actually obstructs the pulmonary arteries. Now, when it reaches the lungs, the embolus, so that clot is going to block the blood flow, and that is going to lead to an increase in the pressure in the pulmonary artery or the lungs, its oxygen. And that is going to put a strain on the right ventricle or the right side of the heart. And that causes a mismatch in what we call ventilation and perfusion. So there are areas of the lungs that are ventilated, but it is not going to be adequately getting enough blood. And that is going to lead to an impairment in that gaseous exchange. Now, the body's response is going to include to release, you know, our inflammatory mediators, and that can even exacerbate some of the complications like pulmonary hypertension and contribute to the clinical manifestations of PE. But yes, DVT is the most common source of that clot leading to PE, but it's not the sole cause. So you can have these clots originating from other sources. Some people get fat emboli or fat clots if they have a fracture of, say, the femur. And even amniotic fluid can cause embolisms during childbirth. And some people even get air embolisms from intravenous procedures, or even septic embolisms from infections. So there are many other sources that can lead to PE, but they are less common compared to the events that stem from a deep vein thrombosis. So again, it is crucial for us to recognize that any condition leading to what we call a venous thromboembolism or a VTE can actually result in PE. So individuals with cancer may develop clots because of that hypercoagulable state, and certain medical interventions or even medical conditions, such as if somebody has a central venous catheter or even heart failure, that can increase the risk of them having clot formation and developing a subsequent pulmonary embolism.
All right, folks, of course, you listen to Lunchtime Doctor, Freedom 106.5 FM, Sky 99.5, and Sangeet 106.1. And what is most at risk for developing the pulmonary embolism?
So when we're talking about pulmonary embolisms, there are certain people that we know have a higher risk or a heightened risk as compared to others. So people who have prolonged immobility, so the post-surgical patients and the travelers who are traveling long distance and who are going to be sitting down for long periods of time on a plane, a person who has had a history of that deep vein thrombosis or that pulmonary embolism is, again, at a higher risk of developing another one. People who have inherited clotting disorders or inherited blood disorders, certain malignancies or certain cancers, and those undergoing hormone therapy or using oral contraceptives or the OCP birth control pills. Additionally, even lifestyle factors we have to look at. So people who are obese or smoking, and even people who are at an advanced age, they have an increase in their risk for developing these things. Now, in Trinidad and Tobago specifically, yes, the prevalence of the non-communicable diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure is rising. These conditions by themselves also contribute to what we call endothelial dysfunction and a prothrombotic state. And broken down, that really means that the blood vessel walls are not functioning as they should, or they are weaker than they should be. And that is going to lead to a state in the body where clots are more easily formed. So that increases the risk of the DVTs for some people, and even a subsequent pulmonary embolism. So awareness and management of all these comorbidities is going to be very much essential in reducing the incidence of pulmonary embolism in the population. And I mean, some people may not have even heard the term pulmonary embolism, but it is actually something that we do see, unfortunately, in the hospital, sometimes even on a daily basis. And it was so frequent at one point that I actually was part of a study conducted to go through all the risk factors for PE in the Southwest Regional Health Authority. So there are a number of persons in Trinidad and Tobago that suffer with pulmonary embolism. So it is something that we as a population need to be aware of. We need to know the symptoms, the risk factors, and even the management and complications that are involved.
Now let's take a break from our sponsor, Amco Healthify, and come back with your questions right here on The Lunchtime Doctor.
Life moves fast, so healthify yourself every day, starting with naturally brand almond milk and all-inclusive cereal. Quick plant-based fuel for your morning. Healthify lunch with Bragg's apple cider vinegar, adding a splash of goodness to salads, and Bragg's liquid aminos for stir fries. Tetley and Caribbean Dreams range of tea help you relax, recharge, and healthify your afternoons. And after your workout, refuel with naturally browned almond milk and all-inclusive for a protein-packed recovery. Amco gives you so many ways to healthify your day with naturally browned almond milk, Bragg's apple cider vinegar, liquid aminos and refreshers, all-inclusive cereals, Tetley and Caribbean Dreams teas.
All right, folks, get ready to call us up at 625-2257. You know the drill, and 627-3223. WhatsApp us at 306-1065. You could even send your messages to Sangate and Sky, and they will send it right to us here in studio. All right, so let's go. Hello, good morning.
This boy.
Yeah, man.
My favorite doc. This is such an interesting, educating program, doc. So, doc, which means now your blood is, no, some people's blood is too thick. Right? And they take blood thinners, aspirin or whatever. So what you're saying is that it is kind of dangerous to have your blood thick. So we should use thinner. It's very interesting. We'll listen off it. Thanks a lot.
Right. So there are certain medical conditions or certain states that your body may be in, for example, somebody who has cancer, or again, somebody who has an inherited blood disorder, those people, they may have states where their blood may be thicker than it needs to be. Now, in the average person, our blood is normal, it's fine. Once you have no risk factors, you should be okay. But in those people, they may be prescribed something like an anticoagulant. But in the average person, we do not need to be taking those things unless prescribed, unless you've had an event that warrants you to be taking blood thinners, etc. So there's no need to unnecessarily be taking anything to make your blood thinner. Your blood is as it should be. If you need to be taking any sort of anticoagulants, those things will be prescribed to you. Those things will be picked up by your doctor and it will be prescribed. So there's no over-the-counter anticoagulant that you should be consuming on a daily basis, because then that's gonna come with its own problems. If you are not in a hypercoagulable state, meaning that your blood does not clot easily, then you can risk hemorrhaging if you're taking these things for an extended period of time.
All right, this one came in from yesterday. I remember somebody called in and talked about sleeping. Say, good day, doctor. We have found that sleeping with your cell phone near you, is it true that sleeping your sleeping area causes us to wake up with a headache when it is switched on? Is that true?
So, I mean, I can understand that, yes, sleeping with your cell phone very close to your head or using it even right before bed, it can contribute to headaches because, you know, that blue light exposure, the cell phone itself is going to emit blue light, and that interferes with your internal production of melatonin, and that is supposed to regulate your sleep cycle. Now, if you have exposure to that before bed, especially if you hold your phone very close to your face, that is going to disrupt your sleep patterns and lead to poor quality of sleep. And that is a common trigger for headaches.
All right, let's try line one here. Hello, good afternoon. Hello? All right, lost that one. Hello? Good day. Welcome to the lunchtime, doctor.
Yeah, good day, Baze. Good day, doctor. Doctor, okay. I wanted to ask you, just under your ribs on your right side there, feeling a little discomfort, not pain or anything, but I don't know what part of the body is there or whatever. What might be some of the possible, what is happening there?
So it really is dependent on all the other symptoms that you may be feeling as well. But one of the most common things that we do see, especially if somebody is complaining of right upper quadrant or right under the ribs, if they're complaining of pain at that point, people may usually get it after eating fatty foods, and that means that they may be having some sort of gallbladder issues, whether it is gallstones itself or cholecystitis, which is inflammation of the gallbladder. Sometimes it can be attributed to liver problems, but if the pain is something that is coming right after or a few minutes after you eat some sort of fatty foods, more than likely it is a gallbladder issue. It can be attributed again to the liver. It could be fatty liver disease. That can be due to either alcohol, or it could be due to eating too much negative foods in your diets. Some people get gastritis or even acid reflux, and sometimes they feel it in weird places. That can also be a cause, or it could even just be some sort of rib issue or some inflammation of the cartilage where the ribs sort of attach to the sternum. So those are the main causes that we will see, but definitely if it is something that is coming with other symptoms, especially if you find yourself getting fever and vomiting, etc., you need to go and get yourself checked out.
All right, so this is Doug. Good day, Doug. This is a person that called a few weeks ago about cutting his toe, one of his toes, a piece of glass, and over weeks felt it getting numb. It's starting to get numb, not spreading to any of the other toes, though. But he does intend to go to the doctor. The wound is healed, but the toe is still getting numb. Was that just damage to that particular toe, or is something more serious and severe?
So it could possibly just be that he had damage to the nerve of that particular toe. So the wound has healed, and every other part of the foot, if he's feeling, you know, sensation, it could just be that the nerve or the vessel right there actually has some sort of injury to it.
All right, so cool. But is there a cure for that? I mean, you just go to the doctor, we'll give him medication or something, or that's it for the toe?
So it's really hard to say. There's no sort of medication that can actually, you know, regenerate your nerves just like that. But if it is something that is repairable, they may look at that. If it is not something that is very severe, some people, unfortunately, tend to live with it. You know, B12 is good for nerve regeneration as well. So that is something that he can look at.
Okay. Good afternoon, Doc. Hi to Dr. Britz. Is there a right way to massage the lower back? Spasms. Well, the lower back, they get spasms. Yeah.
So when we're looking at massaging the lower back, You want to obviously be facing a comfortable position. So if you're in an uncomfortable position, you're not going to get any sort of relief. Make sure you're either lying on your stomach with a pillow under your hips and, you know, make sure that you're not doing it too rough or too deep for that person. If it is hurting or the pain is excessive, they're not actually getting any sort of relief. So you have to start gently and maybe circular motions as well, especially focusing on those muscles and the areas that are more tight or tense. But you have to start gently because the pain may be overbearing depending on how severe the injury is to the lower back.
All right, I did see another call coming in here, but we'll save it. After you feel free to call us back, caller, we will be taking another chance again to take some more of your calls and your messages. Let's get on with our topic. Are there any lifestyle factors that increase the risk of PE, such as long periods of inactivity or certain medical conditions?
So, yes, there are certain lifestyle factors that actually significantly influence a person's risk of developing a pulmonary embolism. So that prolonged inactivity, so extended bed rest, whether it's for a surgery procedure or they've had heart attacks, etc., or even just sedentary behavior during, you know, your long flights, you're sitting down for long periods of time or long car rides. These things can lead to venous stasis. And that is just a big term for the blood sort of pooling about in your veins instead of moving or flowing as it should. And that is going to promote clot formation if blood stays in one place for a length of time. Now, obesity is another critical factor. Having that excess adipose tissue is going to contribute to your body being in a pro-inflammatory state and even in a hypercoagulable state as well. And that is going to elevate your risk of these thromboembolic events or these DVTs and the PE as well. And of course, medical conditions we have to look at would be things like the heart disease and cancer and even inflammatory disorders. All of that increases a person's pulmonary embolism risk. For instance, when we look at certain cancers, they can produce substances that promote clotting, and the inflammatory conditions may lead to injury of the blood vessels and even, increasing the activity of your coagulation factors as well. And, you know, we have to start addressing the modifiable lifestyle factors. So the things like obesity, regular physical activity, weight management, and if you're a smoker, that is another thing that increases your risk of developing these DVTs and PEs as well. So smoking cessation is going to become important, and they all substantially reduce a person's risk for pulmonary embolism.
All right, so another reason to quit smoking, guys. So can pregnancy or hormonal birth control increase the risk of pulmonary embolism? If so, why?
So yes, pregnancy and hormonal contraceptives are actually associated with an increased risk of PEs. So during pregnancy, you have a lot of physiological changes going on. So you're going to have an increase in your estrogen levels and even compression of certain veins because you have this growing uterus inside of you. That is, all of these things are going to contribute to that pregnant woman being in a hypercoagulable state and even venous stasis as well. So these changes are going to elevate her risk of developing a DVT and a subsequent PE. And the period in which she's at highest risk is actually in that postpartum period. So right after she has given birth, a woman is at highest risk for developing the DVTs and PEs. Similarly, when we look at hormonal birth control methods, particularly the ones that contain estrogen, that can increase a person's clotting factors and reduce your anticoagulant proteins. So that is going to lead to a heightened risk of thrombosis or that clot formation. However, you know, we have to look at the absolute risk for women. It is actually low. So it is essential for, you know, us as doctors to assess a woman and her individual risk factors. So a personal or family history of VTE when we are prescribing these contraceptives as well.
All right. And what are the common signs and symptoms of a pulmonary embolism? And how can someone distinguish them from other conditions like a heart attack or pneumonia?
So a pulmonary embolism is commonly going to present with a sudden shortness of breath, chest pain that is sharp and worsening when the person takes deep breaths, a rapid heart rate, and sometimes a cough that is going to produce blood-tinged sputum. So, you know, these are the main symptoms that we do see, but other persons may have other symptoms as well. So dizziness, excessive sweating, and swelling in one leg if that deep vein thrombosis is present. Now, the severity of the symptoms are going to vary depending on the size of the clot and the extent of the lung involvement. A large embolism can cause significant strain on the heart, leading to low blood pressure and potential circulatory collapse, meaning that you are going to have an issue with your circulation or the way that blood is being distributed to all the different organs and tissues in your body. Now, it is important that we know how to distinguish a pulmonary embolism from other conditions. The symptoms of a pulmonary embolism can mimic, you know, the same symptoms of, say, a heart attack or even pneumonia or severe pneumonia in some cases. But a heart attack is typically going to present with crushing chest pain that radiates to the arm or to the jaw, and that is not usually affected by breathing, whereas the pulmonary embolism pain, it's going to get worse when the person starts to breathe deeper. Now, when we're talking about pneumonia, that is often accompanied by a host of different symptoms, so fevers and chills and even that productive cough with yellow or green sputum. So it is maybe a little bit easier for some people to distinguish between pulmonary embolism and pneumonia, because you're not going to have all the fevers and the chills unless the pulmonary embolism has gotten to a point where, you know, you have had some sort of severe complication, and more than likely it does not get to that point without you being hospitalized at first. Now, because these symptoms or because these conditions tend to overlap in their presentation, then this is where the diagnostic testing is going to be necessary for an accurate diagnosis. So for a PE, we use something called a CT pulmonary angiography, which is a CTPA, and that is going to basically give us a view of what is going on in the pulmonary vessels of the lungs, and it will help us to visualize whether or not there is a clot that is present.
All right, folks, in a short while again, we'll be taking some of your calls and your questions. Hold on in there. And are there cases where a pulmonary embolism has no symptoms? And if so, how is it detected?
So yes, there are pulmonary embolisms that can sometimes be asymptomatic, particularly when the clot is small or when the body's compensatory mechanisms prevent any sort of significant respiratory distress for that person. And in those cases, the embolism may actually go undetected until some sort of routine medical imaging study, such as a CT scan or even a Doppler ultrasound for another reason, and then it will reveal the presence of those clots. Silent PEs can also be suspected in the patients that have the unexplained shortness of breath or fatigue or mild chest discomfort, especially if they have the known risk factors such as the recent surgery or prolonged immobility. Now, because the asymptomatic or the mild cases may still increase the risk of future embolic events, it is crucial that that person is diagnosed early, we may do something called a D-dimer test, and that is going to detect the breakdown of the blood clot or the breakdown products of the blood clot itself to guide further investigations into that person. The high-risk individuals, the persons with the history of the DVT or genetic clotting disorders, they may also undergo periodic screenings just to ensure that they don't have any clots that we are missing. Now, in some instances, patients who have chronic unexplained breathlessness may actually later be diagnosed with chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, and that is a very long term, which is really just a long-term complication of undiagnosed or untreated pulmonary embolism.
All right, folks, let's take a break from our sponsor, Amco Healthify, and come back with your calls and your questions inside the Lunchtime Doctor.
Life moves fast, so healthify yourself every day, starting with naturally brand almond milk and all-inclusive cereal. Quick, plant-based fuel for your morning. Healthify lunch with Bragg's apple cider vinegar, adding a splash of goodness to salads, and Bragg's liquid aminos for stir fries. Tetley and Caribbean Dreams range of tea help you relax, recharge, and healthy by your afternoons. And after your workout, refuel with naturally brand almond milk and all-inclusive for a protein-packed recovery. Amco gives you so many ways to healthify your day with naturally brand almond milk, Bragg's apple cider vinegar, liquid aminos and refreshers, all-inclusive cereals, Tetley and Caribbean Dreams teas.
Yes, all right, so 20 minutes before 1 o'clock, 627-322-3625-2257. Let's take a call right away. Hello, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon. Doctor, I'd like to find out if you're eating not on time, that will create a headache.
If you don't eat on time, if it will create a headache?
Yes.
Okay.
So that is actually something that we have to look at, especially when we are looking at diabetics. Not eating on time or even skipping meals can actually trigger headaches in some people. So when you skip meals or you go too long without eating, your blood sugar levels tend to drop. And of course, we know that as hypoglycemia, and the brain is going to rely on a steady supply of glucose or that sugar to function properly. Now, if your blood sugar levels decrease, it is going to lead to symptoms like headaches and dizziness and irritability, and some people have difficulty concentrating. So these are things that definitely can occur when you don't eat on time. And for diabetics that are taking medications that already lower their glucose levels, it is important for them to still be eating their meals at a timely manner because they don't want to go hypoglycemic.
All right, let's go to the WhatsApp here. I have a WhatsApp message.
Good day, Doc. What causes thyroid, and is there a cure for thyroid?
So, in terms of thyroids, when we look at certain parts of the body, you know, there are a lot of different issues that can arise from those parts of the body. So when we're looking at thyroid issues, there are autoimmune disorders like Hashimoto's thyroiditis and Graves' disease, and you know, hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism. There are many things that can occur with the thyroid. So there are many different factors that we have to look at, right? Sometimes it can just be autoimmune. It can just be your body's immune system mistakenly attacking the thyroid gland. It can be an iodine deficiency. It can be genetics or even a family history. Sometimes, you know, the risk of developing thyroid problems increases with age, and sometimes women are more likely to develop thyroid issues than men. Even radiation exposure and certain medications and pregnancy, there are many different things that can lead to thyroid issues, and depending on the type of issues, there they have their specific management. There are certain managements, for example, if you're doing surgery, that can cure your issue, and there are certain managements that just manage the symptoms. So it is going to be on a case-by-case basis, and again, it is going to be dependent on the type of thyroid issue that you are experiencing.
Let's get another call. Line one, hello, thanks for holding.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, that's my problem, doctor. I've been to different doctors for it already, but my ears feel so uncomfortable at times. I did that. I went to the ear specialist. He said he saw nothing. Another time I went to another doctor. She said it was a little bacteria. He gave me the medication. That worked. And then it comes back all the time. It feels really weird. And like it feels clogged. It feels itchy. And I don't know where to go again. So I don't know if you can just advise me and see what's wrong with that problem. Thank you.
So the thing with air issues or even recurrent air infections, etc., that can actually be caused by a variety of different conditions. And, you know, sometimes it can be linked to underlying health conditions that you're having. So that can affect the air secondarily. So if you've had some sort of allergy or infections or even certain skin conditions. So some air infections that people may get would be, you know, your otitis externa or even your otitis media, which is your middle ear infection that is caused by bacteria or viruses. And that can give you a fluid buildup behind the eardrum, and that can make your ears feel clogged or full. So if you are experiencing, you know, that pain or hearing loss, and if you have that ear infection, then you definitely need to go and see a doctor to get more antibiotics and even ear drops for that. Now, if you have something like allergies or allergic rhinitis, then the underlying condition would be those allergy conditions. So managing your allergies properly with, you know, the antihistamines or the nasal sprays. And sometimes even excessive earwax, you know, can build up and cause that blockage, leading to that sensation of fullness and itching and discomfort in the ear as well. Some people may have skin conditions like eczema that can lead to all of that. But, you know, to get down to the root of the problem, they're really going to have to actually pay attention to what symptoms you are experiencing. And of course, again, look in the ear and maybe do a deeper dive. But it sounds to me like you are either having some sort of recurrent infection in the ear, or it could be an underlying issue, like an allergic issue as well.
All right, let's say hi once again to our listeners out there in Sky 99.5 and Sangit 106.1. Your questions coming up as well.
Doctor, what is the worst case scenario if having a trigger finger, is it an operation? And two, I don't drink alcohol, but yet I was diagnosed as having a fatty liver. Beside alcohol, what causes a fatty liver? Thank you for your service.
So when we are looking at trigger finger, you know, that is actually when your tendons in your finger becomes inflamed, and sometimes your finger gets stuck in this sort of bent position and then suddenly snaps or triggers straight. Now, in most cases, we may do like a non-surgical treatment. So we'll splint the finger, we'll rest, we'll give you some anti-inflammatory medications or even steroid injections. But in the more severe cases, if the condition is not responding to those sorts of conservative treatments, and if you're experiencing some sort of significant pain or discomfort or even loss of function of the finger, then surgical intervention would be involved. So there's either open surgery or something we call a percutaneous trigger finger release, which is more minimally invasive, where they will make a small incision in the palm and use a needle and a small tool to release that tight section of the tendon. So in the worst case scenario, that is the management for somebody who has severe trigger finger, but the condition could lead to permanent stiffness and loss of function or even an inability to use that finger properly if it is left untreated for an extended period of time. But those things are relatively rare. So if you know you have trigger finger, please go and get it treated so that you don't have the permanent loss of function. Now, in terms of fatty liver disease, or what we call hepatic steatosis, that is when the fat or excess fat starts to accumulate in your liver cells. And yes, alcohol consumption is one of the most well-known causes, but there are several other causes. So obesity or excess body fat, especially excess abdominal fat, is actually a significant risk factor for developing fatty liver disease. And even things like insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, high triglycerides, and a poor diet, a diet that is high in sugars and processed foods, and a sedentary lifestyle, sometimes it's just genetics, certain medications as well, all of these things can contribute to fatty liver disease. So alcohol, yes, it is one of the main causes, but it can also be caused by lifestyle factors and underlying conditions like obesity or even PCOS.
All right, another some other messages coming in here.
Doc, how dangerous is aspirin?
How dangerous is aspirin?
So when we're looking at aspirin, right, aspirin has anti-inflammatory properties, but it also has anti-coagulating properties, meaning that it is, quote-unquote, what we call a blood thinner, and that is why it is prescribed in sometimes small doses to persons who have had heart attacks to ensure that, you know, they're not at risk for developing heart attacks again. But it is generally considered safe when it is used as directed. But, of course, any medication is going to carry potential risks, especially if you're not using it properly or when you have certain health concerns that are present. So you can have aspirin being very harsh on your stomach, and it can cause irritation or more complications like ulcers or even gastrointestinal bleeding. And one of the primary effects of aspirin is its ability to inhibit blood clotting. And, you know, that blood thinning effect can also be dangerous, particularly if you have a bleeding disorder or if you're taking other medications that affect blood clotting like blood thinners or certain supplements. And that excessive bleeding could even occur with very minor injuries. It could lead to kidney damage and allergic reactions to persons that don't even know that they're allergic to aspirin. So there are risks that are associated with it. If you are not prescribed aspirin, you should not really be taking aspirin. I know some people can get it over the counter, but there are other safer alternatives. But for the people that are prescribed aspirin, you are prescribed aspirin for a reason. So you have to take it as prescribed.
All right. Lots of questions coming in here. Good day, Doc and Bass. Great program listening from Dutch in St. Martin. Can you explain what is light chain disease with the high FLC LAM BDA of 481 milligrams/L?
Can you repeat the high FLC?
Yeah, high FLC, LAMBDA, 481 mg/L.
So that is actually, that's not something that we see very often. I do know a little bit about it. Light chain disease is really just a group of disorders in which you have abnormal protein chains and that are produced by what we call plasma cells, the cells that are responsible for producing the antibodies. And these abnormal chains start to accumulate in the organs and the tissues, and they lead to damage or a certain condition that is known as monoclonal gammopathy. And there are two main types of light chains in the body. So we have kappa and we have lambda. And light chain diseases are really often seen in conditions like multiple myeloma or amyloid light chain amyloidosis or even light chain amyloidosis. Now, I honestly can't really give you a full breakdown of that high FLC and the lambda levels, but it can be, what I can tell you is that it could be indicative of a potential problem. So it is important that this person follows up with their treatment, because like I said, it is used in monitoring conditions like multiple myeloma or light chain amyloidosis. So all of these things are going to be necessary. And maybe next week we could talk about multiple myeloma, because it is something that everybody should know about or have some sort of knowledge about. So what I would tell that person is ensure that you are following up with your doctor and getting the appropriate diagnosis and treatment as well.
All right, another question here. Fasting sugar level in the morning was 100, sugar level in the evening after eating also 100. Is this normal?
Fasting sugar levels in the morning, 100. Yes, once it is less than 114 to 126, it's fine. 80 to 100 in terms of fasting is usually good. And in the evening after eating, yeah, that is also fine as well. For some people, they're, depending on what you've eaten throughout the day or how much meals you've had, it may not even go up as much.
Let's get one from our listeners at Sky 99.5. Hi, good day, Doc. I love oats and peas, but every time I have it, it causes stomach burns. Is it that I shouldn't take it?
So that may just mean that you are not... If you're experiencing something like the acid reflux after eating things like the oats and the peas, it's likely due to several different factors. But oats and peas are generally considered to be healthy, but sometimes if it's an excessive amount, it can cause some sort of digestive comfort. So oats are good for overall digestion and your heart health. But for people, especially if you have a sensitive stomach, all the fiber-rich foods like the oats could lead to bloating and gas and discomfort, and that could potentially contribute to that burning sensations. And oats contain a specific compound that is similar to gluten, which for some individual, again, that can have a problem in the stomach. Now, if you are eating an excessive amount, it is going to cause a lot of irritation. So what I would say is probably cut back on the amount that you are consuming, or don't even have it on a daily basis. Maybe try it on a weekly basis instead.
Let's get our final question. What's up from Sangeet? Good afternoon, Doc. When I stand for long hours, I get a cutting pain under my heel, like taking a knife and cutting it. Also, I get cramps and tingling in my both calves. Can you explain, please?
So if you are getting those symptoms, again, it can be due to a variety of different factors. So the pain under the heel could be something like plantar fasciitis. And the plantar fascia is basically a very thick band of tissue that runs along the bottom of your foot from your heel to your toes. And overuse of that, especially from standing too long or walking or running, can lead to micro tears in that tissue. And that is going to lead to inflammation and pain under the heel. Sometimes heel spurs or these bony growths develop on the bottom of the heel bone. And that is often associated with the plantar fasciitis, like I said. Now, if you're getting calf pains, again, it could be from standing too long. Maybe you are experiencing some sort of venous issue or some sort of valve issue in your veins. So I would suggest that you probably go and get it checked out before it does get any worse. Sometimes standing too long can lead to pooling of blood in your legs and lead to pain in the calves as well.
All right, so we just have about 2 more minutes. I think we'll finish up with some of our calls there. Follow-up question. Let's get this last one here. Good day, doctors. Is okra good for type 2 diabetes?
So in terms of okra, yes, it should be fine for type 2 diabetics because it isn't really, it's not high on the glycemic index, and it has its benefits as well. So that low glycemic index, it's rich in fiber, and it does have some antioxidant properties, and it has potential to regulate cholesterol levels, which is going to be very important for persons with type 2 diabetes. So I would say, yes, okra is definitely something you can add to your meals. And again, it's not high on the glycemic index. So having, of course, you're not going to have an excessive amount, but having a good amount of it is going to be fine.
All right. 1 minute, one question. Is a draining seton for a fistula tract painful?
For a fistula tract, a draining... if you are doing a procedure, they usually will numb you before they do any sort of procedure. You may get a bit of discomfort during the procedure, but it should not be extremely painful. For some people, they may get some level of pain depending on how deep that tract does go. So it really is dependent on the person, but more than likely, you can even ask them to give you beforehand if you would like that.
All right, thank you there very much, Doc. It's been a great week. Thank you for answering all our questions and for the great topics.
Yes, I will see you guys next week.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.